more realistic idea of the kind of things that we often use Mathematica for when we do some research problem. So something a bit more realistic, maybe not so broad as the kind of thing that we did last time. But I wanted to give you an example of something that, for example, I used recently to check some particular formulae concerning scattering amplitudes of gravitons that were discovered just last year, for example. So one thing that we often do with Mathematica, one thing that we often use Mathematica for is to check just formulae, check conjectures. And by check, I mean not only verify that they are true, but tweak factors of two, signs, and whatever to make sure our formulas are perfect and solid. So often it's very useful to use Mathematica as a way of just checking conjectures, producing data, and checking whether some two expressions that we might write from totally different points of view, whether they are the same or not. So, but before that, I thought of explaining you a bit some things about kinematics of scattering amplitudes, namely, what are the kind of variables, what are useful variables that we can use to describe scattering amplitudes. So a scattering amplitude is an amplitude for a scattering process. So it's it asks for the momenta of the particles that we will scatter, p1, p2, p3, up to pn, if we are scattering n particles. These are on-shell momenta. So for example, if we are dealing with massless particles, they are null. So pi square is equal to 0. And the amplitude is a function of those momenta, p1 up to pn, also of the helicity of our particles, and eventually of colors of particles, and so on. Is it clear? So you compute the few scattering amplitudes, right? Probably gluon, electron-electron scattering, and stuff like this. Right? Okay. So I realize that probably you don't know enough group theory to understand fully what I'm about to tell you. However, we will check that there is indeed a very useful way of generating null momenta, of generating data for this scattering amplitude. You will see explicitly that it works. The underlying group theory behind it, you probably will not be able to fully grasp what I'm about to tell you, but I think you will get a flavor of how these things work. So let's think a bit about scattering amplitudes and kinematics. So we have a scattering amplitude, which is a function of p1 up to pn. Now, let's suppose we are scattering, say, gravitons. Okay? I'm actually going to show you some very spectacular formulas that Hodges recently proposed that describe remarkably, because they are so amazingly simple, the scattering of n gravitons. Okay, so you take n gravitons, you scatter them, you compute the scattering amplitude, even at tree level. If you have like 8 gravitons before these kind of formulas, it would be very, very hard to compute. But now it's possible we can compute 12, 20 gravitons. We will compute them in Mathematica in half an hour or so. So this, if they are gravitons, then the momenta, the particles are massless, so each momenta is null. We will consider this amplitude as a function of the momenta. So for us, for the purpose, let's take these guys to be arbitrary. They can be complex. We don't care. It's like we are dealing with functions of momenta, rational functions. We can treat them as complex numbers. So it's an interesting problem to impose some reality condition in what we are about to do to make sure the momenta are real, but we never care about this, and we will deal with complex momenta as if they were real. That is irrelevant. And now if you think for a bit, even the zero order step, if you want to check some scattering amplitude, which is to produce the arguments of the function, is not a trivial task. So if you say that you want an amplitude with 12 particles, so you want to find 12 momenta, it's a scattering amplitude, so the momenta, there is momentum conservation, so the momenta add up to zero. Right? So the momenta add up to zero, and they are null. So to find a set of vectors that add up to zero and are null is a very non-trivial problem. The fact that they add up to zero means that we can concatenate one after the other. So draw the vector p1, add the vector p2, and so on. We add up all the vectors, and because the total momentum is conserved, we describe in this way a closed polygon. Now, to find a polygon, you start drawing it with no segments that closes, it's very hard. So if you think for a while, I told you in the very first lecture, I gave it as a problem for those who knew already Mathematica, to try to come up with a solution to this problem. How to generate random data? How to produce, say, 12 particles that add up to zero and that are all null vectors. It's very hard. You add some null vector, you add another, but at the end it doesn't close. The distance between the last two points is not null. And you try now to tweak, to change one of the vectors, to try to see if you can make that distance null, but then you screw up something else and you try to change, and it's very hard at the end to make it close. So this is kind of a problem. This already hints you that if it is so hard even to generate what the amplitude is a function of, maybe this is a hint that these guys are probably not the best variables. If there were some variables for which it would be trivial to generate this data, maybe the amplitude would look nicer in those variables. Okay? So the kind of hint that we might want to look for. So indeed, so the first thing we can do, so let's try to find some variables, and let's do the following. Let's, in this polygon, where we have p1 up to pn, notice that we are scattering gravitons. So what I call particle 1, 2, 3, 4, of course, these numbers is irrelevant. At the end, the amplitude is invariant under changing p1 with pn and so on, but by convention, I pick some order. Okay? Just for the purpose of drawing, I pick some order. Once I pick some order, this defines a polygon, and I can define this edges of this polygon and adding some x variables, x1, x2, x3, and so on, such that my vector p is a difference of two x's. So let's see, p1 is x2 minus x1. Okay, so far I didn't gain much. Now I have to find a sequence of cusps. By the way, I said that this order is irrelevant. If it was a gauge theory, there is a notion of planar diagrams that you might have seen. I think you've encountered it in one of the tutorials or in one of the homeworks of Consadavid. And in gauge theory, so where you scatter gluons instead of gravitons, the amplitude decomposes into a sum of color-ordered amplitudes, which are amplitudes where the order of particles is fixed. So you have an amplitude, you say, there is one order where 1 is to the left of 2, to the left of 3, to the left of 4, another where 1 is to the right of 3, and so on. You change another order, and you decompose your amplitude into different orders, and then, indeed, these polygons have a very precise meaning. But here, no. Here we are gravitons. There is no particular order. P1, P2, P3, up to Pn. You can reshuffle them, but you pick some order just for your convenience. Okay? Now, what is this x1 and x2? This xi, this xj, are points in Minkowski space, in R1,3. Okay? Now, there is a very nice way of thinking as Minkowski space, as the space of light rays in two higher dimensions. Okay? Just a statement, mathematically, it's totally trivial, but conceptually, it's kind of funny. So let me explain you. So let's consider some vectors, capital X, M, where M runs from 1 to 6, so these are in 6 dimensions. And these vectors are null, okay? And they are projectively identified. So X is identified with lambda X. In other words, are light rays. So they are null vectors, and I don't care about the magnitude of the vector, so it describes a ray. And it's a ray in 6 dimensions in the signature, where the signature is minus, for example, something like this. Okay, or let's do, for example, something like this. So there are 2 times and 4 space directions. Okay, so this x is a vector in R2,4. Now, light rays, if a light ray is identified, then for each x, we can pick a representative, we can pick one representative of the light ray by taking a section, by choosing some section of those light rays, and choosing as a representative the following. Let's say that the first component, we choose it to be one, okay, let me explain. I'm changing notation from here to here, so I will have to explain. Small x squared and x, okay? So here I'm using this plus, 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 minus signature, so I'm putting a small small four dimensional vector here, but here I change from time and space, these are two light cone directions, okay? So this is like time plus space and this is time minus space. So you see that this vector here is null because x squared is equal, so it's light cone, so it's just the product of these two coordinates, which is x squared minus x dot x, so it is by construction a null vector. So I choose the first two components to cancel exactly the magnitude of the last part. So you see that there is a very explicit map. So if you give me some point in Minkowski space, I can construct a null ray in six dimensions, okay? It's nothing special, it's just a map. So you take me some vector x, I put them in the last components of a vector and I put the first two to be one and the magnitude of that vector, okay? So this is kind of interesting. And now something very remarkable happens, which is that some transformations in this four-dimensional space, some particular transformations that make lots of sense for massless particles, namely conformal transformations. Just one second, let me just finish this sentence. So have you heard about conformal transformations? Do you know what they are? So the conformal group is kind of like the Lorentz group, but with a few special generators. So you have translations, you have rotations, you have dilatations as a symmetry. And you have inversions, which is kind of the special one in the conformal group. That's the less intuitive one. So you can do these transformations. If you have some theory which has no scale, it will have this conformal symmetry, typically, which is, we'll have this conformal symmetry. Okay? So conformal field theories are theories which have this important symmetry. And massless theories at three level do have this. Yes?
Would you mind explaining the one again? I mean, why do you put one there?
No, this is just, see, this is some light cone direction, it's another light cone direction, so the scalar product between this is like one half of this guy times this guy plus this guy times this guy. Yes, something like this. Okay. So if I go to light cone coordinates for the first two, okay, if I write this guy as x1, okay, this is not 2, sorry, 3. Do I want this 2? Maybe not. If I write this light cone coordinates, then this is x1 squared, okay, an overall minus. This is x1 squared minus x2 squared, so the middle components all have the same sign, this is all this plus here, and the first and the last, they have the different sign, the different signature. Okay, it's very convenient to use sometimes some light cone direction, some combination which makes it light cone. Then the scalar product is just multiplied to components, it's very simple. Okay, so then the scalar product is just this component times this, which gives x squared, plus the contribution from this, which is again x squared, and therefore it is indeed a null vector. So what I was saying is that in this space, in this R2, 4, there are natural transformations that act on light rays, namely Lorentz transformations. You can just boost these light rays around. If you ask then yourself, what does it translate for this point in Minkowski space? These Lorentz transformations that are very simple transformations, just linear transformations acting on the six-dimensional space, they generate conformal transformations of the four-dimensional space. So they linearize the conformal group. So it's something extremely convenient. It's a good hint that these are kind of very good variables to describe massless processes involving massless particles. Is it clear? Not totally clear, probably, because most of you don't know what a conformal group is. But mathematically, you can understand just the kind of change of variables that I'm doing, right? So it will become, hopefully, very clear why this is very powerful as a way of generating null momentum. Okay, very good. So is there something else I want to say? By the way, I can tell you something funny. So what are light rays? Let's see. Let's suppose we are doing some x1, x2, x3. Okay. And consider the set of points where x1 square plus x2 square minus x3 square is equal to minus 1. Okay? So let's suppose that we are that we consider this problem here. So before that, let me just mention something. What I'm saying so far, I said that we are in R1, 3 to do four dimensions. If this 3 was D, all you had to do is instead of this 4, you would consider D plus 1. Okay? If this 3 is D, here it's D plus 1. So when we are doing this, when I'm writing x1, x2, x3, let's suppose that we are considering a simple example where D is 1. Or you can think that this x3 represents all these variables. Symbolically represent 3, 4, 5, and 6. Now let's suppose we consider this surface embedded in this higher dimensional space, this capital X space. What is this surface? Well, if x3 is equal to 0, if I add the right sign here, which I don't, so I want what? So x3 goes here. No, it's okay. If x1... No, it's not. Sorry, I have a mistake. If x3 is equal to 0, this is a circle here, right? Is it okay? This is a circle. And when x3 increases, if you put x3 on the other side, you see that the circle increases. So this describes an hyperboloid. Like this. Is it clear? Yes? Now, if we consider a light ray, what is a light ray? Well, it's some guy that goes through the origin, right? And asymptotes, as it goes to infinity, this light ray, okay? So a point, a light ray, asymptotes to the hyperboloid, right? So this is the same. So we notice something interesting. A point in Minkowski space can be thought of as a light ray. But a light ray asymptotes to the hyperboloid. In other words, a light ray, they are also the boundary of this hyperbolic space. Right? At the boundary of the hyperbolic space, as you're going to infinity, you approach these points here in the boundary. But these points here in the boundary, they are in one-to-one correspondence with the light rays. So we see that there is a correspondence between points in Minkowski space, these light rays in two dimensions higher, and the boundary of this hyperboloid. But this hyperboloid is nothing but what is called the ADS under the Sitter spacetime. So this is some nice, this, if you want, is, so for here it's just a mathematical construction. But actually, these variables are also very useful in the context of the so-called ADS-CFT correspondence, where some theories in four dimensions are related to the physics of string theory in entities in space in one more dimension. So you see that this hyperboloid, it's a surface in three dimensions, right? So it's a two-dimensional space-time, right? It's a two-dimensional space-time. I can go here or I can go here. So it's a two-dimensional space-time. The boundary is a circle, it's a one-dimensional space-time. So the boundary of this hyperboloid is a one-dimensionless object, and it is exactly flat space. So the boundary of antidesiter is flat space, and if you want, if you propagate inside the boundary, if you propagate from the boundary inside, you go to this hyperboloid. If you are at the boundary, you are describing flat space. This is just a small digression, but it's a cute one, I think. Very good. So far I didn't tell you why the six-dimensional is useful, so let's continue. We have to continue a bit more. Now, okay, so now how am I going to motivate the next step? Let me think. Okay, very good. So, this vector xm, capital Xm, this m is a vector index. Now, if it was a usual vector in two dimensions, we would say it's an SO3 vector index. It's a vector in six dimensions, we would say it's an SO6, except that the signature is not exactly plus 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 plus, but it is 2, 4, so this is what's called an SO2, 4 vector index. So the comma just indicates that two components are timelines. Okay? So the SO1, 3, what is the SO1, 3 rotation group? It's just Lorentz group, for example, right? So when we have time and space, rotations between time and space are just boosts. Okay, so we have an SO2, 4. Okay, SO2, 4 is roughly the same as SO6, apart from some signature issues. Okay. Now, there exist some so-called sigma matrices, which are like gamma matrices, in six dimensions, that are 4x4 matrices, sigma m, ab, which are written here in this Mathematica notebook. And you can think of them as the analog of gamma matrices, but they are called six-dimensional sigma matrices. So they obey some algebra like gamma matrices, like product of these two sigmas give the metric in 2, 4 signature and so on, exactly more or less like a gamma matrix. Okay? So I could tell some more properties of these sigma matrices, but they are kind of useful matrices with which you can contract this vector index here. From a group theory point of view, the way you can think of it is that this A and B, they are SU4 indices, or SU2, 2, and SU4 is the same as SO6. So does someone know what SU4 is? No, not really. So SU2, yes, right? So SU2 is defined as unitary 2x2 matrices, SU4 is defined as 4x4 unitary matrices. So it's possible to go from an index, from a vector index, which is like some representation of SO6, to another index, which is like a fundamental index, which is the sigma MAB. So all you have to do is contract an X with a sigma. So if you contract some XM with some sigma MAB, this defines some XAB. These matrices, if you see, they are all antisymmetric. So this is antisymmetric. So let's just see that the number of degrees of freedom is okay. Here we have six components. And here, because it's 4x4 matrix, which is antisymmetric, we have 4 × 3/2, which is 6 components. Okay? So that's the number of degrees of freedom works. Okay? Very good. I realize this is harder than I thought. You really need to know a bit more. Okay. Well, now I should finish. Very good. So then, the next step, which is the less trivial one, to the extent that it was only proposed in 2009, is to introduce some twisters. OK? Okay, so twisters are projective variables like the x's are. You see that x is invariant under x goes to lambda x, so it's a projective variable. These twisters, they are also. And the idea is to write this sigma AB as give me just 1 second, sorry. Yeah. As some Z A, Z tilde B anti-symmetrized. So it's possible to introduce some four-dimensional so-called twisters, so some four-dimensional vectors which are projective, such that XAB is a product of two such twisters. And to finish, let me just write. Okay, I think maybe I'll go to Mathematica now and show you how all this works so that it becomes very explicit and you see this working. So let me summarize. So let's see. What do I need? Very good. So the idea is the following. I need one more step. Sorry. Okay, so far what I've seen to have done is the following. I'm telling you that now each point is parameterized by a pair Z and Z tilde. From each Z and Z tilde, I go to a capital X. From this capital X, say AB, I go to this capital X, M, from which I go to the spacetime X, mu, from which I go to the momentum P. Okay? So, this looks like a boring change of variables. Why am I doing all this? It looks a bit strange. But in principle, except for this step, how do you go from XAB to XM? Because I only told you the inverse map, but you know how with gamma matrices you go from one map to the other. Just multiply by some gammas, take some trace that projects into the corresponding gamma, and there is some trick like that. Why is this useful at all? Well, it's useful because you can ask, what is now the condition that it's null, p squared? Well, p squared translates into x minus x squared. X minus x square is nothing in this language but the product of x and x prime. Okay, you can check that the inner product of two light rays, if you use this representative here, indeed give you the difference between the 2 points square. And in this language of this, it becomes, if x is associated to the twister z, z tilde, and this guy to W, W tilde, this becomes just the determinant of a matrix where you put these vectors as columns of this matrix. Now, this becomes extremely powerful because to make a determinant vanish, it's very simple. So if Z tilde is equal to W, it works immediately. So if we say that the twister, there are two twisters for each point, if one of them coincides with one twister of the next point, automatically, consecutively separated points are automatically null. Okay? So just by taking a random set of numbers, if we say then that Xi is given by a pair of twisters, Zi plus 1, then Zi plus 1 shares one of the twisters, Zi plus 2 shares one of the twisters with Zi, and so on. Automatically, we make sure that p squared is equal to 0. Also, because we are specifying points and then just uniting the points, momentum conservation is also automatically implied. So this trivializes the problem of satisfying that momentum conservation is trivial and nullness of the momenta also becomes trivial. So what you can do is really randomize four-dimensional vectors, this Z's, work out this map, and you get perfectly fine null momenta. Okay? So, and if you try to fight with null momenta and to find configuration of null momenta, you can really convince yourself that this is extremely powerful. And a very beautiful geometrical idea that people could probably have thought way before, but it was really only discovered by Hodges and also by Aldana Maldacena in 2009. So let's see how these constructions work. How can we use this to produce sequences of null momenta? Any question? Again, the proper way to explain this would be to explain it in some more group theory background, which I know that you didn't have exposure yet, so I'm trying to make it very explicitly, but I agree that for you this probably just looks like a bunch of dark magic, like I do just a bunch of steps, and at the end I tell you that everything will be perfect, everything will be fine, and indeed we'll see it is the case. But is there any question that you want to ask, either about the more fundamental aspects or about the notation? Or yes?
Is the Lorentz group of XO6 isomorphic to the conformal group of XO4?
The the answer to your question, once I rephrase it a bit more properly, is yes. So Lorentz transformations in six dimensions are isomorphic to conformal transformations in four dimensions. Okay? So the way it works is that here we have conformal transformations. Conformal transformations involve in particular very nonlinear transformations of these four-dimensional variables. For example, you can have a transformation where you take a point, shift it, invert it with respect to the origin, and shift it again. This gives rise to what's called special conformal transformations. Okay, I could write explicitly what this is in terms of X, but it is a nonlinear map. Once I go to this embedding, so-called embedding variables in six dimensions, those conformal transformations become Lorentz transformations, very simple transformations. Once I go to these four-dimensional twisters, those Lorentz transformations become SL4 transformations, so linear 4 by 4 matrices, even simpler than Lorentz. So this is trivializing as much as you can the conformal group by going from P to so-called momentum twisters, and it's trivializing momentum conservation and the on-shell conditions. Okay? So let's see how this works in practice. So our goal is to click shift enter and generate some set of polygons, some set of momenta which are null. So first I entered here some sigma matrices. I took this for some book or so from some paper. And it's often useful when you write some code like this to make it into what is called format style code. Okay, because code allows you to write inline formulas like this that go on to the right. If you only want to run it once and you don't care that the formula goes to the right, this is quite convenient. Okay? So suppose we are going to scatter six gravitons, and we want to generate six null momenta. Okay? So what we want to do is we want to first generate some random Z's. Okay, so we can use random integer. If we say we want a random integer, why integers? You might ask, because, well, there's no particular reason. I just like integer. So this is how you generate a random integer, say between minus 400 and 400. Now, why is it sometimes more useful to deal with random numbers? Why random? Because we want to check some formulas on some particular moment or whatever. Why is it more useful to use integers than, say, real numbers? Because once you use integers, and then you are checking formulas, you have infinite precision, right? So at the end of the day, we will be dealing with very big fractions, but they are fractions which are exact, 177 over whatever, but it's an exact fraction. And then we will check. So this is what is called a semi-analytical check. So you do replace by numbers, but you keep them integers or fractions so that you have infinite precision. So if we want to generate here a sequence of vectors as an option of random integer, you can say that I want a matrix of random integers. So I want six vectors of size 4, which are all made of random entries. Okay? And as I said, we in general, we don't care whether they are real or not, so we can have some real and some imaginary parts. Okay? So these are some random, six random twisters. So remember that the first point is made out of these two twisters, the second point out of these two, the third point out of these two, the fourth out of this, the fifth out of this, and the sixth out of the last and the first. Okay? So this is the main idea. Very good. So we generate this sequence. So we call this our twisters, this, such that the first one is this vector, for example. Very good. Then, what we want to do is to consider a vector which is z, a, z, b. Okay? So given two vectors, you can construct a matrix by just multiplying the two vectors. So what product is this one? It's just tensor product, right? So you just made a matrix out of two vectors by taking v1, v2, v2, v3, and so on. So tensor product is also called Kronecker product. Okay? So if you take Kronecker product of the first z and the second z, this gives you a matrix where each entry, which does exactly this, so it takes the first z. This is, for example, first z component 1 times second z component 1, and so on. So this implements this part here when I multiply two guys. I don't anti-symmetrize yet. I didn't anti-symmetrize. I just multiplied. I did ZA, ZB. Now I have to anti-symmetrize. Okay? After anti-symmetrized, I get this XAB, and I want to extract X. And to extract X, I multiply by a sigma matrix, take some trace, and use some orthogonality property of the sigma matrix. Because I multiply by a sigma matrix, which is anti-symmetric, I actually don't need to anti-symmetrize, so this is fine. Okay? Again, you are not expected to follow the details, but to have a feeling of the kind of things we are doing. So we take this product between the two, okay? And we then multiply by a sigma matrix, okay? We multiply by a sigma matrix, one of them, sigma number m. And we do this, one second, and we take the trace, and we do this for all the m's. So m up to 6. So this generates a vector, so I multiply by sigma matrix and take the trace, and this way I extract this component xm, this six-dimensional vector. Now, with the sigma matrices that I have, it's a good question, why do I have this that I'm written here? If j is equal to 5, okay, so I think basically I forgot an I in one of these sigmas. Okay, let's hope everything will work, but apparently there is an I missing here. Okay, so we construct this, and this is our list, our six-dimensional vector. Okay, this is our x1, okay, our six-dimensional vector. If we want to go to four dimension, remember this is a light ray, I can rescale it at will. If I want to go to four dimensions, I should normalize it such that the first components are 1 capital X square, and then the last component is what I think of as my four-dimensional vector. Okay? So the normalization that I want is the following. I normalize it such that the first components are 1 and X square. That means I take the object, I take this object, and I divide it by, a convention that I'm using, it's something like this. So this means, so again, what does this mean? This means that this trace here, remember? This table here is a vector with six components. It's this vector here. And now what I'm doing is saying, take that vector and divide by a light cone direction. Okay, this I is because of signature again. Don't pay too much attention by i's, 1's, minus 1's. We will see that everything is perfect. But I'm being a bit sloppy about signs. Okay? So this is equivalent to normalizing it in that way. But here I'm not explicitly using Lightcon coordinates for the first two. I divide by one of the Lightcon directions. This is equivalent to setting this particular normalization. Then the last four components should be exactly my vector. So after doing this, I take the last four components. Okay? So this would be, for example, x1. So it would be the vector that corresponds to x1. It has four components, and this is one way of getting my vectors. So I can say that my vector xa, okay, is equal to what? I use a here, and here I use a plus 1. So this is almost perfect, except that there is one case where it doesn't work. So x1 is good, x2 is good, x3 is some vector. But when I do x6, I have a problem because she asks for x7 and x7 doesn't exist. So that's just, I should just put some mod here, okay, to see, say that 7 is the same as 1. And now when I ask for x6, this is giving me the four-dimensional vector, okay? So this is our four-dimensional vector. Maybe we should not call it capital X, but small x. Okay? So the claim is that this is it. You take some z's, you see it's just two lines. You take some random z's, you construct this xa, and these are the cusps of a null polygon. You see? If this solves the problem, believe me, this is highly non-trivial. So maybe it doesn't because there might be typos, but let's try. So what are our momenta PA? Our momenta PA are just the difference of two x's. Okay? So it is just x a plus 1, again with mod, in case we are choosing the last one, minus xa. Okay? Small x. Okay? Oops. What is eta, our Minkowski metric? It's a diagonal matrix which has entries 1, 1, 1, minus 1. This is our signature. And this is our eta. You see, it's a matrix with those entries. Okay. So now let me show you that indeed this works perfectly. So if I have P1, this is the vector. Let's see, is it null or not? So we multiply with eta, right? Dot p1, and indeed, it's a null vector. Okay? This is the same as doing p1, the first component square, plus the second component square, plus the third component square, minus the fourth component square, and it's perfectly z. And if I ask, is p2 also a null vector? It is. We can check that all p's are null, and we can check that they add up to zero. You see? So it works beautifully. So this might be some kind of black box, but well, here is the solution. So a way to generate momenta is to consider the difference of two cusps of this polygon, where to generate the cusps of the polygon, I can just take some momentum twisters and use this embedding language. Okay. So try to think for a while how would you do it in the usual way, by just adding vectors and then trying to impose on Chalmers condition on the last one, and you realize that this is really something very cute. Okay, any question here? Is there any question?
Excuse me.
Yes.
I don't get that normalization factor.
You don't understand why this is what it is?
Yeah.
So, this normalization factor makes sure that out of the light rays, that I'm picking the same representative for all the light rays. Okay? So that I'm picking a section of this light rays and always using the same section for all the vectors. Okay? So if you see otherwise, this map will not work. Otherwise, it is not true, for example, that the distance is proportional to the scalar product of two axes. So if you want this product of two axes, this is proportional to this guy once you use the same section, for example. Okay? And dividing, this is dividing by a light cone component. You might think, why there is an eye there? There is an eye there because probably there is an eye too much somewhere else. Because, okay? So if would you understand if it was something like this? Then it's divided by some light cone direction. Would this be better? Here there is just an eye because we are dealing with complex matrices and there are eyes everywhere. And again, you should not follow the main technical details. I just want to give you the physical picture, which is you start with a point, you map it to light rays in six dimensions. Light rays in six dimensions can be decomposed into twisters. Twisters trivialize on Chalmers condition because if each light ray is a product of two twisters, then this automatically is describing null polygons. So this is the basic idea, and I just want to show you that it's very simple to implement it, and in this way to get trivial momenta, P1, say, P2, P3, and so on. They are complex vectors, you see, and but they are null. Okay, so this is a check, we can comment it. Okay, very good. So, so let's see, what can we do? So, now we could either okay, let's do something simple to relax a bit. This is a bit too conceptually. Let's do something simple. Let's, for example, plot these polygons, okay? Let's plot these polygons that are closed polygons and that describe these configurations of momentum. So how can we plot these guys? So first of all, they are complex. So okay, if we want to plot, let's plot, say, the real part of them, okay? Then we can plot the imaginary part as well. The real part should also be a closed polygon. Now, this is a four-dimensional vector, and we cannot see in four dimensions, so we also need to drop one of them. Say, let's say we want to see, we drop the first component. Okay? So we have three vectors. Okay? We are seeing the space part of our configuration of momenta. Again, it should also be a closed polygon and add up to zero. The space, time, everything should add up to zero. Okay? And now, we do this for all our points. Okay, for all our six points. By the way, yeah. For all our six points. So now this is a sequence of points which should be the cusps of our polygon. These are our axes. Okay? And now, actually, these are our axes. Okay. These are our axes. Okay. Now we can ask to draw this all the sequence of axes. We can just ask to draw a tube with this axis. And to show this, and this draws a sequence of edges, you see, that are our polygon. We add vector, 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 vector. And then it doesn't close because I gave a sequence of points x1, x2, x3, x4, x5, x6. And then if I want to close it, I should add the first point at the very end. Okay, that's simple. So let's add the last point. So let's join. So we can use this for a function of just two arguments. Join this with x1. What happened? Okay. With this stuff. And now you see you have a nice closed polygon. You cannot see very well, so we can paint this cube red so that you can see better. And we can make it a bit thicker, Okay. So this is a polygon, a sequence of vectors, which is null. So you start here, you add them all up, and you get a nice closed polygon. Very good. So this is how you generate momentum. Any question here? I'm tempted to stop here, just in the sense that I realize that maybe this is a bit too advanced. So, I have two options now. Either we stop here, or we go to questions and answers, and you can ask me whatever you want to know about Mathematica. Or I move on and show you these scattering amplitudes for gravitons. How do they look like? How's the scattering, and what's the formula for scattering of anti-gravitons? Up to you. Yes?
I just have a question about it. So, is it simple to extend the result for more than 6 momentum?
Yeah, it's very simple. You go up and you change 6 to 8, and you run again. Now it's 8. And you can also do 10. Another poll. Wow, you see, one of them. This is high energy scattering. It's true. The momentum are huge. More? So to each of these polygons, you see, there is a corresponding amplitude of probability for n gravitons to scatter with this configuration of momentum. And the remarkable thing that was discovered recently is that that formula is nothing but an n by n determinant of a very, very simple matrix. Why it is what it is, and it's really a total mystery right now. One example where you have an utterly simple formula at the very end, which you don't understand its origin very well. Yes?
If I wanted to use sort of a more conventional approach to finding it, set of null vectors. What I was sort of thinking of doing when you had originally proposed this kind of problem in the first place is if you build, let's say, the regular polygon that corresponds to that, like let's say a hexagon for 6 of them, and then you define a set of rules for moving one vertex of it such that the two line segments that it affects are still null after you move it. And then you basically...
Yeah, you could do that.
So
if you have 2 points, they're null separation of 2 points defines a circle, right? It's intersection of two light cones. Now you can move this point in that circle, right?
Yeah.
So you move it. Now you take this point on the two next and you find another circle. And this way you can move, yeah. But you see how painful it is. This trivializes all that.
Yeah.
And you have to start with one configuration where you know it's null, then you want to go to some place very far away and you have to do all these operations many times and so on. You would have no idea how to go there. Okay. So, tell me. I'm not offended. I have a lot of stuff to do. Should I stop here and leave you with this beautiful polygon? Do you want to see the amplitude for n gravitons? Or do you have questions about Mathematica and the weak contractions and simpler stuff?
Can you continue with what you're planning to say?
Okay, very good. So now you will be lynched afterward by our colleagues, but okay. Very good. So let me then just show you how this amplitude looks like, because now it's really not so hard. So you can ignore now everything we have done so far, and that. And just suppose that I gave you already some table, some momenta, P1 up to Pn, okay? So I gave you some momenta, P1 up to Pn, so here is a table. Okay, matrix form is better. So this here are some momenta, so let's go back to 6, it's simpler. So here are some list of vectors, some four vectors, there are 6 vectors. So this is the data. So you want to know what's the amplitude for this piece. So the first part was just how to generate piece. Now we have piece. Okay? Very good. So now that you have piece, it turns out that we have to do one more change of variable. But please keep in mind that right now the piece are given. So we are only doing one change of variable. So you can now forget about all these x's and z's and so on. They were only useful to construct p in our construction. Now we have p. So we have p1, we have p2, and so on. Okay? Is it okay? So we take one given p, okay, a given pa, and we construct the following quantity. We take p1 minus p2, some I, over pa, the fourth component minus the third component, and for the other one you put one. So you construct a two vector out of your P. You take the first component, the second, the fourth, and the third, and this is what we call lambda A. Okay, so we call this guy lambda A. Okay. And we define also some lambda tilde A, lambda tilde A, which is defined in a very similar way with a plus and this stuff in the second component. Okay. This is a crazy definition. I'll explain now why. What is this? Let me just check the signs. This looks okay. So for each of our vectors, we define this lambda A and lambda tilde A. So you see lambda 1 is some vector, lambda 2 some other vector, lambda tilde 2 some other two-dimensional vector. So we have two-dimensional vectors for each momenta, lambda and lambda tilde. These are what are called spinners. And they have the following property, that if you construct let me show you. Suppose I construct these two vectors, lambda and lambda tilde, which is, you see, p1, p2, plus I, here p3 and here p4. I just want to show you how they look like. So this is one of the lambdas, and the other one is p1, p2 times I, p4 and p3. So this is what we call lambda, and this is what we call lambda tilde. And they have the following nice property. If you construct a matrix out of lambda A and lambda tilde B, okay, if you construct a matrix, what happened here? Ah, okay. And simplify. We'll simplify using the fact that the momenta is null. It doesn't simplify the first one, but this first component is just p3 minus p4. So the claim is that this is nothing but the scalar product of p with the Pauli matrices. Four-dimensional one, the two-dimensional ones, and the first one is the identity, and the other one are the three-dimensional Pauli matrix. So this is just making a two-dimensional matrix out of our momenta, and this is quite useful because if you construct this kind of matrix, The determinant of this matrix is automatically zero, and it's and the fact that it is zero is equivalent to saying that the momenta are null. Okay. Anyway, I could go into some explanation, but take this as a definition. These are what are called spinor variables, and the amplitude is very nicely written in terms of these spinor variables. Again, there is some group theory. You can present the explanation of all this. A vector is a four-dimensional vector. It transforms onto the Lorentz group. The Lorentz group is also SU2 times SU2, and these lambdas are the two-dimensional objects which transform in a fundamental representation of SU2. So if you take these vectors, rotate them, rotate these lambdas with SU2 matrices, and see what it implies for P. For P, this implies that P is transformed under Lorentz transformation. This is a useful way of, instead of dealing with Lorentz transformations for these four vectors P, you deal with SU2 rotations for the lambdas and lambda tildes. Okay? Okay, anyway, this is just definition. And then you define some scalar products of these objects, which are very simple. You take a vector, one lambda A and one lambda B, and you take their determinant. So this is invariant under SU2 transformations, because if you have two rows and make a unitary transformation, and inside the determinant, this is just invariant. So this is what's called an SU2 scalar product, or a Lorentz invariant scalar product. And this lets use some notation AB, this angle bracket, to denote this determinant, this SU2 invariant scalar product. And the same thing with tildes, let's use some other brackets, which I don't know how to enter it by heart, so I will copy it from another file. I always forget, which is this one. I can copy this line so that we don't lose time. So we make some replacement, some rep here, you see, that replaces angle brackets by determinant of lambda A, lambda B, and these funny brackets, which is, we can now ask what they are if we use full form, replaces by the determinant with lambda tildes. Okay, so this is double bracketing bar. Again, double bracketing bar is some function which is useless, it just displays nicely. So we have some replacement rules for replacing SU2 scalar products of lambdas and SU2 scalar products of lambda tildes. Okay, so now it's done. The claim by Hodges is that MHV scattering amplitudes is extremely nicely written in terms of this, in terms of these objects. Okay? So the claim is that these are the kind of the nice variables for describing amplitudes. For example, now you, let me just explain you why this is so, these variables are so nice. For example, the scattering amplitude. The simple scattering amplitude, the so-called MHV scattering amplitude of gluons, the scattering amplitude of gluons, you might think that they will look very nice as expressed in terms of momenta, P1, P2, up to Pn. But no, they look the nicest when expressed in terms of these angle brackets, AB. When you express them in terms of AB, the amplitude for scattering, for example, n gluons, up to some trivial factor, is just the scalar product 1, 2, 2, 3, and so on, up to n1. Okay? So this is how remarkable this amplitude is. This is how this gluon scattering amplitude looks like. For gravitons, it's not as simple as this. It's kind of more complicated, but much more interesting. And I thought we could implement this formula. But I think I will just show you how it is, because okay, it's indeed too advanced. I should. So let me just copy and I'll just show you. This sounded easier yesterday night, but okay. Very good. So the claim by Hodges is the following, that if you construct a matrix, a table, involving these ratios of these brackets, so the off-diagonal elements, if I is not equal to j, they are just some ratio of angle brackets over of straight brackets over angle brackets. Whereas if I is equal to j, you have some sum over the ratios of these angle brackets and curly brackets, where what enter here in all these brackets, you see they are external variables. I and j go up to n, where n is the number of gravitons that is being scattered. And then there are two blue guys here, L and right, which appear in Hodge's formula, but the claim is that you can put whatever you want and the result doesn't change. So we put some random numbers here, and we can change them and see that the result doesn't change. Okay. So maybe you can say, can't you write them in a way that they disappear? No, it's not known how to write it in a nice way where these kind of auxiliary guys disappear. But this is what they are. And then Hodges tells us that the formula for scattering gravitons, it's very nice. It goes as follows. Take this matrix, okay? Take this matrix, remove column number 1, 2, and 3. Okay, so remove some columns of this matrix. And then remove some rows, row 1, row 2, row 3. This is what we did here. Actually, probably we removed rows first, yeah, and then we removed columns. But doesn't matter, it's just relabeling. So how do you remove rows of a matrix and then columns? You remove rows first. This is what this delete does. C1, C2, C3. And then you transpose, you rotate the matrix, and then you remove rows again. Very good. And then the claim is you get a matrix where you remove three of the entries, and then you take the determinant of the remaining matrix. And you can choose whatever columns or rows you decide to delete, and you compensate by some very simple factor that resembles the amplitude of gluons. Okay? And now there are lots of claims. The claim that this lambda L, lambda right doesn't matter. The claim that you can choose whichever columns or rows you remove, that it also doesn't matter. And there are all these claims. And indeed, we can run this and just check that we remove different columns. Say we remove column 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 4, or we remove columns 1, 2, 5, and rows 2, 4, 5, and we get exactly the same results. And we can check that if we change this guy to 1 over 18 and run, nothing changes. We get exactly the same number. And this is the kind of formula that is a delight for a theorist. This formula could hardly be nicer to describe the scattering of, say, 200 gravitons, and at the end it is just the determinant of this very simple matrix. It's like totally amazing. And right before Hodge's formula appeared last year, the next to the best formula was what's called the Mason-Skinner formula. David Skinner was postdoc here until last year, and that formula involved a sum over permutations, and for example, I have both implemented to compare one to the other, and whereas the other one can take like hours, this one takes seconds to compute. So, how was this formula found? This formula was found by playing with examples, by studying this amplitude, seeing what's the amplitude for 4 gravitons, 5 gravitons, 6 gravitons, 7 gravitons. And then Hodges miraculously recognized that it could be packed, all these formulas, into this very simple determinant. But then, as always in physics, for sure, there is a beautiful explanation of why this determinant is appearing. What is this telling us? What is the role of these auxiliary spinners that play no role? Why are these the right variables? What's the physical meaning of this matrix with some diagonal and some off-diagonal elements? Is this some kind of Jacobian from some hidden variables to these variables, and this is the origin of this determinant? What's the origin? Shortly after, Freddy and friends asked whether they could generalize this kind of amplitude for this particular scattering of gravitons, which is also the analog of this simple scattering of gluons. This is the simplest amplitude for scattering gravitons, for more general gravitons. And they found also some remarkable formulae that describe all possible scattering amplitudes of all possible gravitons, written in a way that resembles some kind of string theory. Again, it's not at all how it was derived. It was by writing the kind of known results in a way that resembles some sort of formulas that most naturally would come from string theory. Does it mean that there is a dual string theory that is computing these amplitudes and so on? And these are the kind of things that often when we do research, we do. We take some amplitudes, we check, we compute some numbers, and we check that indeed stuff is invariant, that it doesn't depend on the twisters. we take other representations and we compare other representations with these ones and we check that we get exactly the same result. This I was going to do, but I think it's way too much. And that's it. This is one typical use of Mathematica, which is more mundane, just as a calculator, as a way of checking statements. And you see here, you can check it analytically, you see. This, before I apply numeric, this is a big, big fraction, you see. This is this fraction here. So I can call this Hodges. This I can call Hodges 2. And Hodges 1 and Hodges 2, they are just big fractions. And when I subtract them, I get 0. It's exactly 0. It's not 0 with a high precision, you see. Here I evaluate it, and then I ask to convert to numeric. But I don't need to ask. I can leave it as it is. And I divide one by the other, and I get 1. It is not approximately 1, it's exactly 1. They are exactly the same huge fraction. Okay, I think I'll stop here.
In that formula,
yeah.
The blue guys, R and L, are they reference momenta?
No, they are some reference spinners. Left and right, they play no role. The amplitude is invariant under changing this. The reason why is momentum conservation. You can show that because of momentum conservation, this matrix doesn't care about the choice of this L and right. And but why? What are they doing there? Why are they there? Why is this? Why does this formula contain this reference gas? For example, does it mean that there is some formulation of gravity where you pick some particular gauge in some direction, parameterized by some L and right, and then you are doing some kind of expansion, and the computation in that gauge gives this result, and the fact that it doesn't depend on left and right is gauge invariance, is the fact that you can choose different gauges, and you should always obtain the same result, maybe. So all these kind of things, this is something that people are very excited about, studying this gravity amplitude, because until now, until last year, there was no formula that was manifestly invariant under permutations of the gravitons and as simple as this. So you had terribly long formulas, and you looked at them, and you couldn't even explain that you change particle 1 and 2 and get the same result, even something as basic as this. Whereas here, everything is manifestly symmetric. You start with an n by n matrix, and you remove whatever columns you want and whatever rows you want. And it's absolutely invariant over which ones you remove. So of course, this matrix, there is no reference point. All points, all ij's are equivalent. So this is the first formula for scattering of gravitons that is manifestly symmetric under permutations of gravitons. Yes?
Another question?
So even basic stuff like this was not yet known until last year.
What paper or review do you recommend to study this formula? Do you have the archive?
These formulas? I recommend the last two papers by Freddy. Yeah, on gravity amplitude. They generalize this, but they cite this paper by Hodges. There are no reviews yet. This is 1 year old, so. Yes?
Is there any restriction for the lambdas? I mean, can they be collinear?
Can they be what?
Collinear or not?
If they are collinear, these guys become divergent, and you have soft and singular. You have soft divergences, and of course the amplitudes diverge. You need to regularize them. You need to study the behavior as you approach the collinear limit. You cannot take them to be collinear, strictly collinear.
Yeah, is it because the reference momenta, when you write for
example, no, when they become collinear to the reference momenta, you mean? Then no, nothing happens. So when I and L become parallel, this determinant vanishes, but there must be cancellation somewhere that makes sure that this is not singular. So there are singularities naively in this formula when I approaches L, right? Because this determinant is zero. This is what's called a spurious singularity. It must cancel out in the full result. And indeed, it's not there. We just checked that it doesn't depend on lambda L and on the right. So there can be no singularity because nothing depends on them, in fact. So they are not there. It just looks like they are there. Yes?
More basic question about Mathematica in
yes.
general.
Very good.
When I'm trying to put things into a nice form,
yes.
Sometimes I use simplify and it doesn't work and I need full simplify. Sometimes
yes.
I have to do something else like power expand and then
right.
collect it and then simplify and blah, blah,
yes.
blah. For me, it's sort of a process of trial and error to
yes.
find what works.
Yes. Yes.
Is there some more more systematic way to figure out how to simplify things?
No.
Okay.
Typically, the best is factor. Factor is very good. So typically, I do factor first, then simplify, then full simplify. The one thing that you should be aware is that full simplify is very slow. And typically, it's better to first simplify and then full simplify, rather than just full simplify. And sometimes it's better to first factor, then simplify, then full simplify. It's faster to do three things than just go for full simplify. Of course, this is stupid. It shouldn't be like this, but this is how it is. Now, there are... So, okay, let's go to basic stuff. Suppose we have... this. I like this example. 2 minus cosine p. 2 minus 2 cosine p. And we ask to full simplify. And it doesn't full simplify. If we have 2 cosine of 2p and ask to full simplify, we get 4 sine square of p. Okay? So, it's kind of fun. Here, what we can do, if we want mathematics to be smart, we can say p goes to 2p. And at the end, p goes to p over 2. Right? Now, what was work? What was wrong? What was wrong is that, what is this expression? This expression is a 3, which is plus of 2 with product of minus 2 with cosine of p. And what is this expression here? So let's see both of them. And what is the other one, the one we want? 4 sine of p over 2 squared. So here are the 2 3s. So if you look at the trees, you agree that the first one is simpler than the second one, right? So what Mathematica does is, roughly, she counts how many leaves the tree has. So if you count how many leaves they have, 6 minus 2 cosine has 6 leaves, so 6 boxes, and the other guy has 10 boxes. But if I try with 2p, okay? So if I put here 2p and here p, it's the other way around. Now the first one is the complicated tree, and the second one is the simple one. So Mathematica tries to simplify reducing leaf count. And if you really don't, if you want to use another function to simplify, for example, say, I hate gamma function, for example. You can, so there is a weight to each, you can give weight. You can say that, for example, signs are very bad. Then Mathematica will try to replace them by cosines. Okay, so there are options, you can give options to full simplify, saying that instead of just applying leaf count of an expression, do the following. Do leaf count and add the number of signs. You can play this kind of games. Then you should go to the help of full simplify and see how you can do more options. In practice, it never works. And you have to live with simplify / full simplify. But sometimes you think it will work. I think it's better. More. Yeah.
Also, there's general question.
Yes, so very good.
Given a Hermitian operator, how can you find the unitary
you do eigenvectors, you diagonalize.
Okay, so or more general, suppose this Hermitian operator is a complex one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a problem. So let's say, for example. So let's write an Hermitian operator, say, 4x4. So here is some complex matrix, right? So here is some complex 4x4 matrix, and we can, this is not Hermitian, we can make it Hermitian. Right? By adding the Hermitian conjugate. So this is an Hermitian matrix. Is it okay? It's just as our toy model. Okay? Matrix H is Hermitian. Now we compute what are the eigenvectors of this emission matrix? Okay? And we get this, so root, blah, blah, because she's trying to do it analytically. So let's make this matrix numerical. These are the eigenvectors. Okay? So in other words, let's make this matrix numerical. Otherwise, she will do it analytically, and it will take forever. Then we compute the eigenvectors of this matrix. This is our rotation matrix, U. Right? Okay, now it's just a question of figuring out how to do this. Let's try to diagonalize it. Now I never know by heart, but it's something like this, right? Okay, so if this doesn't work, it's inverse here. Here it is. So U transpose. So here it is. So your object is the transpose of the eigenvectors. This is the matrix U1. Right? It's just diagonalization of matrices, no? Was this your question? So here is a matrix. Here is the matrix that diagonalizes it.
Okay. So did you define the superscript H and C and
T? Sorry?
Did you define the superscript H and T? I mean.
Ah, this H there. Ah, no. This means emission constant. Yeah. So if you ask, if you emission conjugate of a matrix is the same as matrix scape S C scape. What happens? Emission conjugate. What's the problem? It's not like this. This is the emission conjugate of the matrix. I can do I conjugate and then transpose, right? This is what emission conjugate is, right? More questions?